Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And the lights stayed mostly on in the Northeast as the snow fell and the winds blew overnight. We consider who is responsible for that, the lights business, really. I mean, when you get right down to it, it's Thomas Alva Edison. We'll talk about that later this hour. The president is warm and cozy, meanwhile, in Saudi Arabia today, and we consider if the coziness of the U.S.-Saudi relationship is consistent with U.S. principles of human rights and our stated policy of endorsing freedom and democracy in the Middle East. That's also this hour. But to use this much less than advertised blizzard as an example this hour, the police told people to stay indoors in New York City and the Northeast, and they did. To stay off the roads, they did. People trusted the mayor, who warned of a historic storm here in New York City. Important to consider this idea of trust in the police and in authorities. All week long, we are talking about the role of trust in policing and how police focus on small infractions, project a reassuring sense of order in the community by doing that. Yesterday, we spoke to one of the authors of the so-called broken windows strategy of law enforcement.
For me, broken windows has always been subsumed or is a tactic under community policing. And if you move away from community policing, I think you're moving away from the genius of Anglo-Saxon policing. And that is that police operate on behalf of citizens, they have to work with citizens, and they ought to determine the priorities working with citizens and the standards of neighborhoods within the law working with citizens. And if you forget that and start pushing beyond in the name of getting more arrests or driving crime down just that much farther, there is a point at which you can begin to question, is the cost of reducing crime in terms of developing antagonism so great that we're not going to push this hard?
George Kelling, social scientist and author of, co-author of the Broken Windows Strategy of Law Enforcement. We spoke to him yesterday. And now we want to get a view from the police perspective. We bring you Sunil Dutta, who's a police officer in Los Angeles, who after getting his master's and PhD in biology, he joined the LAPD, where he has worked for the last 17 years. Sunil, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much. Before we proceed, I just want to add a disclaimer that I'm here as a private person and I do not represent LAPD. Whatever I say is going to be my own opinion.
Understood. But your views of the workplace and the sort of day-to-day sort of implications of community policing for a police officer, you can speak to. What's it like to actually execute the broken windows policy, to focus very hard on small infractions on the daily beat?
Well, let me give a real-world example of what community policing is like. When I finished my probation and I went on the street, all idealistic and starry-eyed about wanting to serve people and help community and everything that a young police officer hopes for, I was assigned to a beat where there was lots of drug sales, a lot of shootings, gang activity, all kinds of horrible things. And what we discovered was shocking. None of the people we talked to was interested in us chasing gangbangers or drug sales or shooting or anything. The only thing people wanted to do for us to do was, hey, there's so much garbage in the alleys. There's so much graffiti here. Please write tickets on Santa Clara Street because people are speeding. Our children play there. And what a revelation it was that my agency had its own idea of what was good for the people. That is, go catch the drug seller or try to stop the shooting. But the community members had totally different needs and demands. And that's what community policing is all about.
You've written about this. What's the community's responsibility to enforce trust and to build trust with law enforcement? You've really said that in many ways the community has to abide by what the police say to a greater degree to prevent things like what happened in Ferguson.
Well, it wasn't a book I wrote. It was just an op-ed, and it synthesized only a component of that. The vast majority of the public abides by police, and a vast majority of the police officers are professional and respectful. my comment was directed towards that small minority, extremely small minority, which instead of following the law, choose to challenge or attack the police. If you look at the number of actual numbers, between 2003 and 2009, police made approximately 98 million arrests. And at that same time, there were less than 3,000 arrest-related deaths by police. That's 0.0003% of number of arrests. So in reality, the number of actual use of force or actual shootings is minuscule compared to the total number of contacts the police have. So that's the real reality.
How would you assess the level of trust between the community and police in your experience? And what do you think people need to know about the experience of being a cop that would help them to understand?
One major thing, and I say to everybody that, hey, do not rely on the depiction of policing as you see in a Hollywood movie or in a television show, because let me give you a basic fact. People often say, hey, you could have shot this man's gun out of their hand. Why did you kill them? And even if he was pointing a gun at you, you could have shot him in the leg. Here's the reality. In real life situation, when there's a life-threatening situation, majority of the time it happens with between 7 to 20 feet, and 7 to 8 times out of 10, officers miss when they shoot back. This is the failure rate. The hit ratio is really small. There's adrenaline, there's fear, people are looking at the threat, and they miss. So policing sometimes is extremely ugly. People need to understand that. When we make an arrest, there's nothing peaceful or kind about it. When a use of force occurs, it is not a pretty sight. People need to understand it. It just doesn't happen that you shoot someone in their hands or in the legs or in their gun-carrying arm. That's next to impossible.
Sunil Dutta, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Sunil Dutta has worked for 17 years as a police officer in Los Angeles. He's also an adjunct professor of security studies at Colorado Tech University. Carrying on with that conversation, in the aftermath of notable incidents of police violence and the subsequent racial tension in New York City and Ferguson, Missouri, and other places, the call is for more trust between police and citizens. The question you are responding to this week is, what is the police role in your community?
Hi, this is Jerry calling from Corvallis, Oregon. I think a good indicator of how communities view the police is when you look at the youth. The youth of today has a back-off, very tenuous relationship with the police. So I think that's going to be a good indicator of our future relationships with law enforcement.
My name is Mike Stone, calling from Kirkwood, Missouri. And the police around here are very confrontational. If you address them with anything but yes, sir, or no, sir, it's attitude given back. And it's not the racist issue. It's your social class. If you're poor, it's nothing but tickets. If you have a nice car, nice job, you get pulled over, you're not getting a ticket. It's like they feed on the poor. You give them attitude, game over.
We're really grateful for all these windows on individual communities around the nation that we're getting from you. From Portland, Oregon, the police in West Lynn are amazing. They seem to really care about us, our town, and often make themselves a part of the community in more ways than just when there is an emergency. They are at parades, educating our schools, as well as attending fairs, community celebrations. I feel very lucky to live in a town with such a dedicated police force. Or Amherst, Virginia. I've personally only had excellent interactions with police where I felt heard, listened to, and believed, but I'm a white woman. I honestly worry all the time about my black son, because the reality is that people of color are targeted and scrutinized in a way I don't experience.
Hi, this is Pat calling from South Lake, Texas. We live in the suburbs. When I moved to an affluent neighborhood 5 years ago, I was getting pulled over about 3 times a year for driving while Mexican in my sporty black car. I got a 20-year-old Mercedes and problem solved. No further incidents.
Hi, my name is Mike. I'm calling from Nassau County. I think the police do a terrific job. I feel very safe because the police are out there. I think all these people having problems with police, they shouldn't be criminals. Do what the police tell you to do, and you won't have a problem.
Hi, my name is Kathy. I'm calling from Boston, Massachusetts. The police in my neighborhood like to hand out search warrants with four armored police cars with tanks and about a dozen police officers with assault rifles. That is what I witnessed today at 4:30 in the morning to arrest one guy. That's my view of the police, a militarized police force.
And to bring us to the present moment, the police and authorities called for people in the Northeast to stay indoors and to stay off the roads, particularly in New York City. They shut everything down, and people heeded the police's call. So there's a certain level of trust in the community when weather is at stake. Call us at 877-8MYTAKE. We want to keep this conversation going about trust and community policing. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
President Obama arrived in the Saudi Arabian capital of Riyadh today. That's the sound of a welcoming military band playing the Saudi national anthem. The president is there to pay his respects following the death of King Abdullah and to spend time with the new leadership in the kingdom. The late king is called a reformer. But what passes for reform in Saudi Arabia might be more familiar to someone from the 14th century, where flogging as a criminal punishment was as common as it is today in the Saudi kingdom. The new direction for Saudi Arabia's foreign policy is said to be conservative, but deciphering what that means in this deeply conservative kingdom is also hard to see clearly. Toby Jones is Associate Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University. Toby, welcome.
Hi, John.
And also with us is Ali Al-Rizvi, a Pakistani-Canadian writer and friend of Raif Badawi, a liberal blogger who was publicly flogged in Saudi Arabia. Ali, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Ali, what do you make of this visit in terms of all the implications of the flogging of Raif and your sense of where human rights stand in Saudi Arabia right now?
Well, I personally think it's depressing. It's not surprising. Unfortunately, I mean, the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have had a very long-standing, close relationship, despite all of the human rights abuses that Saudi Arabia carries out on its own citizens that are really not that much different from ISIS and so on. I mean, last year in August, when James Foley was beheaded and the world was reeling in shock, that very same month, Saudi Arabia beheaded 19 people for crimes ranging from cannabis smuggling to sorcery. So this is a country that still executes people for sorcery, and it's completely state-sanctioned. So, you know, the alliance is obviously, it's depressing. Unfortunately, it's necessary at another level, but I think that the time has come for the dialogue to change.
Well, the one thing we should note, and it's probably the only thing we should note there, is those individuals who were beheaded were not hostages, but indeed, execution by beheading for sorcery is unique. And certainly unique to Western audiences. Toby Jones, when someone is described as a reformer in Saudi Arabia, what does that even mean, given what Ali has just said?
Well, it's unclear. I mean, I think from the perspective of American policymakers, you know, Saudi Arabia and others like it in the Gulf in particular are often held up as moderate. And I think in this sense, it's a fairly empty category. All it means is somebody who is basically supportive of American foreign policy aims. It tells us very little about domestic behavior or how the Saudis treat their own citizens. And I think Ali's exactly correct, that this is an incredibly oppressive, brutal regime that holds thousands of political prisoners and treats them very poorly. And while Raif's case has gotten a lot of attention, I mean, this has been going on for quite a long time.
The notion of the U.S.-Saudi relationship has always been, certainly since 1973, that the Saudis have the U.S. over a barrel because, literally, we need so much oil. But that's less the case today, even though oil prices are down. Is there some other reason why the Saudis carry so much weight? Is it perhaps the size of their military that the U.S. has helped to supply?
I think that's got something to do with it. I mean, you know, oil issues still matter. I mean, it's not as though we get much of our oil from Saudi Arabia. Saudi does supply global markets. It's important for keeping prices relatively stable, or at least that's the perception. I think there are other factors at play from the, you know, Obama came out and said today, for example, that both on counterterrorism and on what he calls, you know, Saudi Arabia's role in backing regional stability, another empty term, that the U.S. sees Riyadh as an important partner with respect to both of these things. I do think we can peel back the layers and have a more complicated, perhaps cynical view of all of this. It's also worth noting that while Saudi Arabia has a powerful military, or at least has a big military, a lot of that money gets funneled back through the American economy. It provides jobs and support. I think there are a lot of actors beyond the Pentagon and elsewhere who see this not only as a strategic relationship, but also as a lucrative one.
Ali Rizvi, do you think there's any single incident, and certainly there were lots of opportunities during the Arab Spring, where the human rights relationship in Saudi Arabia will become so self-evident to Americans that things might change?
I think that what's happening with the public outcry, the international awareness, I mean, I've been writing about Raif for quite a while now, about Raif Badawi. What I've seen recently, especially in the aftermath of the Charlie Hebdo killings in Paris, that there is a huge international outcry about Raif's flogging. Everybody knows about it. Everybody's talking about it. Recently, there has been news. I mean, you know, King Abdullah is being lauded and praised worldwide for what he wants to do with reform, specifically for women. But there's now news about his four of his own biological daughters that he has had under house arrest for the last 15 years. So, you know, this just kind of goes to show the hypocrisy and the two-faced policy that Saudi Arabia has kind of owned pretty much for several years now.
Ali Rizvi is a Pakistani-Canadian writer and friend of Raif Badawi, a liberal blogger who was publicly flogged in Saudi Arabia. Ali, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Toby, finally, before we go, do you think there is anything that can change this relationship? President Obama has to project that there are close relationships between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Well, he certainly doesn't have to. There are always choices that can be made. We can revisit our relationship with Saudi Arabia, whether it's a strategic necessity. I mean, I think there are reasons to be hopeful that America's foreign policy in the Middle East can go in a different direction. Negotiations with Iran is a clear example of all of that. But the United States, I mean, the White House and policymaking in this country are captive to the forces of inertia and lots of other interests. It's very hard to steer the ship in, you know, to abuse a cliche, to move things in a different direction. But that doesn't mean it's impossible. I mean, our policy didn't come out of nowhere. It took shape over time. And with some serious commitment and some honest public discussion, I think we can also we can make some meaningful change.
Toby Jones is Associate Professor of Middle East History at Rutgers University. Ali Rizvi, who we spoke with earlier, is a Pakistani-Canadian writer, friend of the flogged blogger Raif Badawi. Toby, thanks so much.
Thank you.
President Obama is in Saudi Arabia today. We're asking you what the relationship should be between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia.
Hi, this is Tom from Dallas. I think we should have a business relationship only with no special treatment from the U.S. government. The Saudi human rights abuses are despicable, and our government should condemn them and have little contact with them.
Hi, this is Heather from Portland, Oregon. I think it's imperative that the Saudis remain allied with us. They're one of our few friends in that region. And as long as they keep the price of oil low, it gives less power to Russia and it gives less power to ISIL or ISIS because they can't make as much money off of what they have.
This is Sam from Tampa, Florida. When a new world leader is installed, our leader of the free world has to meet them. And obviously, we always want a good relationship with anyone. Not going would be a snub and cause serious political problems for us.
We'd love to know your thoughts on U.S. policy with Saudi Arabia or anything else that we're talking about on the program. You know how to reach us. Have your say at 877-8-MY-TAKE or follow us on Twitter. That's at The Takeaway, all one word, at The Takeaway. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. And what would you rather listen to talking about a snowy day? This?
14 to 22 inches of snow. Oh, boy. Road closures, flight cancellations in the hundreds, power outages by the tens of thousands are paralyzing, crippling. Record-breaking storm comes today!
That's a real weather report from AccuWeather.com. Or would you rather listen to the words of Longfellow? Out of the bosom of the air, out of the cloud folds of her garments shaken, over the woodlands brown and bare, over the harvest fields forsaken, silent and soft and slow, descends the snow. Do you have to think about that, which one you'd rather listen to? The snow does make the world seem quieter, doesn't it? Fewer cars, fewer people, less traffic. We don't need a scientist to explain why, when the snow appears, the weather people get louder. But we do need a scientist to explain why the snow makes things quieter. Bernadette Woods-Plackey is a meteorologist and director of Climate Central's Climate Matters program. Bernadette, welcome.
Well, hello. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and it is quiet here in New York with the limited snow that we got. Why does snow absorb sound waves?
It's really a basic physics equation here. We've got water. When it's frozen, it puffs up, and it creates some space in between it when it lands on the ground. So those tiny little snowflakes allow that space to build up. And when you have a sound waves, they get absorbed in that space instead of getting bounced off, similar to when you have carpeting on the floor instead of hardwood floors.
But water in its liquid state, probably helps to project sound. But it's the shape of the crystals in this fluffy context that makes it a very, very different phenomenon.
Yes, the shape is a big part of it. But also it's when they build up, there's little holes, little pockets of air in between all of that. And that also allowed some of that sound to come in and get absorbed. And there's many different kinds of snow, actually, all around the country. And the way we look at it from a scientific point of view, generally, when you look at a liquid equivalent, about 1 inch of water would be 10 inches of snow. When the temperature drops significantly below freezing, we all know that that snow gets lighter and fluffier and it builds more air into it. And you actually get more than 10 inches of snow. So you have more air. So it actually leads to more absorption of sound.
And, you know, when you transfer from rain to ice to sleet to snow, you really are stepping through different sound environments. I mean, the rain, of course, is this kind of wet sound, and then the ice and the sleet have this kind of marble sound, this clicking sound. And by the time you get to the fluffy snow, everything really, really quiets down. And it's all because of geometry.
Well, that is one part of it. But it also does have to do, well, I guess the geometry leads to this too, how they lay and interact with each other. So that is geometry also.
And
you're correct.
Well, I'm not trying to be correct. Do you study the characteristics of snow from the standpoint of what other impacts it has on the environment, like, for instance, the reduction of sound?
Well, some people do. I don't know if that's necessarily a huge area of research right now, but it is embedded in some of the larger research that goes on with snow and its overall impacts on society.
But we can certainly say that Longfellow was right, right?
We can, but I do have to say one thing. In certain parts of the Northeast right now, it's not totally quiet quite yet, because when you have some of these nor'easter-type storms, they really get wound up, and they produce a lot of wind with them. And until that wind starts to calm down, we don't quite get that full-on quiet that you can experience after the storm.
Bernadette Woods-Plackey is a meteorologist and director of Climate Central's Climate Matters. Thanks so much, Bernadette.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Yesterday, three men were charged for working as Russian spies operating secretly in New York, gathering information for the SVR. That's Russia's Foreign Intelligence Service. Two of the men, Igor Sporyachev and Viktor Porobny, were protected under diplomatic immunity and have since returned to Russia. But the third, Yevgeny Buryakov, was arrested and detained in court. An FBI complaint accuses them of gathering information on U.S. sanctions and alternative energy sources. Joining me now, Kimberly Martin, professor of political science at Barnard College. Welcome back, Kimberly.
Hi, John. Good to be here.
What's the backstory here? Can you decode this a little bit, this incident?
Well, if you go and read the entire complaint, what you discover is that they didn't really get anything. They did not seem to get any classified information. They did not even seem to get any commercial secrets. The kinds of things that they were doing was looking for information on the internet, attending trade conferences and business consulting presentations that would be semi-public, helping to formulate questions for Russian journalists who were doing interviews, recruiting students at universities, but there's no evidence that they were successful. And so in many ways, it looks a lot like the complaint that came out in 2010 about the 10 sleeper agents, with the difference being that this time around, all three of them were state employees. Even the one who was working for the bank, it's a special kind of a bank that does investment for Russian state corporations. So it wasn't even really a private bank.
Will the Russians now expel or accuse three U.S. personnel in Moscow?
Oh, undoubtedly. But, you know, a couple things to keep in mind. First of all, this is just really sort of highlighting the incompetence or the apparent incompetence of the people from the Russian Foreign Intelligence Service in the United States. And I think one of the questions is, are we just getting the low-hanging fruit, or do they really not know what they're doing? But the second thing to keep in mind is that this is sort of a diversion from the really important thing that's happening in Russian relations with the West, which is that the fighting in Ukraine is really going up again. It's really swelling. It's getting much more deadly all of a sudden again. And the Russian official comments that are coming out are now saying that it's not against Ukraine, it's against NATO, that the people fighting for the Ukrainian military are actually NATO battalions.
And in one attack over the weekend, 30 people died in one incident alone. So the death toll is increasing as
yes.
well. Kimberly Martin, would you characterize this accusation and this FBI complaint as part of a sanction against Russia, or is it just the mindless turning of wheels of the FBI against Russian personnel who are always being watched and scrutinized?
Well, the complaint said that the investigation started immediately after the 2010 sleeper investigation was made public. And so it was an investigation that was ongoing for several years. But you have to believe that the timing of the announcement about it might have been related to politics. I don't know how that might work.
Do you think the Obama administration has dropped the ball on Ukraine, or is there more news to come?
I don't think there's much more that the United States can do. I mean, I think that, you know, Obama was very clear that we are not interested in getting militarily involved. And beyond that, I mean, it looks like there will be more sanctions put into place. The European Union is meeting very soon to decide whether they want more sanctions. And the announcements that came out today and yesterday seem to indicate that, in fact, more sanctions are in the offing. Beyond that, there's just not much control that the United States has. And so unless we were willing to go to war with Russia over Ukraine, and I hope we don't make that decision, there just really isn't that much more that can be done.
Right now, would you say that the most pain comes from low oil prices for the time being?
The Russian economy is in trouble, and I think the Russian economy is in trouble, not even so much just because of the sanctions or low oil prices, but because of bad decisions that were made by the Putin administration over many years. And the low oil prices and the sanctions are just making a bad situation worse for them.
And we'll see how sustainable that bad situation is. Kimberly Martin is professor of political science at Barnard College, Columbia University. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
Each time we turn on an electric light in a dark room, in a way, we are turning on a time machine.
Put yourself back into this world where everything to do with light was a flame. And imagine that all of a sudden, one day, that changes.
There was a sense in which we were entering a brave new world. That's what Edison represented, you know, the world to come.
135 years ago today, inventor Thomas Edison received the patent for his electric light bulb. It was a moment of bringing light to darkness that would be repeated for decades as the country was electrified and light bulbs became available to all. This story, among others, is told in a new American Experience documentary called Edison. It was produced by our partner WGBH and will air on PBS tonight. You just heard an excerpt from it. The film considers another invention of Mr. Edison's, the idea of a techie American global celebrity. Before Edison, the celebrity Americans were people like Daniel Boone, Davy Crockett, and George Washington. After Edison, in a sense, there was only Edison. Michelle Ferrari is the writer, director, and co-producer of the WGBH American Experience film Edison. Welcome, Michelle.
Thank you so much.
Nancy Kane is a contributor to the film and a historian at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, welcome to you.
Thanks, John.
So this idea of a global techie American celebrity, we think of many people today, but Edison really invented this whole idea.
Absolutely, he did, or at least he was the first. I'm not sure it was completely his creation. I think his contemporaries had something to do with it and were looking for a celebrity to crown. But he was extraordinarily famous in his lifetime. The first full-length biography of Thomas Edison was written when he was 31 years old.
When he got a sense of his personal importance and that a brand could be formed around this idea of constant invention, did it make Edison more competitive, Nancy?
I think it did, John. I think he was, you know, he was a brilliant publicist. He didn't go to school for that. He knew it instinctively. And, you know, as his reputation grew and as others moved into spaces that he had helped create, like George Westinghouse in electricity, he did two things. One, he tried to belittle or outrun his rivals. But the second thing he did was to, in a sense, cultivate even more intently in the growing media interest in him and to try and use that to, as we'd say today, to build his brand and to increase his market share and his, again, to use modern terms, his market power.
And that power stemmed from, and I had to recall this in watching your film, it wasn't the electric light bulb, although that really catapulted him to global fame. It was the invention of the recording device. And here's a little sound that evokes that moment.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow. And everywhere that Mary went, the lamb was sure to go.
Now, Michelle, what's that from there? That's not Edison. That's Spencer Tracy.
Yeah, it's Edison the Man, which was one of the Hollywood films that was made about Edison. There was another Edison the Boy that starred Mickey Rooney. But there is a recording of Edison reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb, but he made it quite late in his life, an extant recording. And you can tell that he's very old, so he cheated a bit.
He cheated a bit, exactly. But again, always cultivating this image and Hollywood picking up on it. Here's Nathan Myhrvold, who's an inventor and entrepreneur, formerly with Microsoft, talking about the significance of this invention.
There was a miracle to it that I think goes beyond most of the things that we would currently experience. Sound was the most ephemeral thing we had. And Edison took it from being ephemeral to being concrete and something that would exist for the ages.
Nancy Kane, every time someone from Apple stands up on one of those stages and unveils a new product, is that an echo of the kinds of events that Thomas Edison used to organize?
Absolutely. You know, Mark Twain once said, history doesn't repeat itself precisely, but sometimes it does rhyme. You know, a lot of Edison's life is a huge, you know, rhymes very, very strongly with, you know, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, many of the other giants, if you will, of Silicon Valley, not only in terms of this is an event, right? The inventor, the invention, and the commercialization or the commercial possibilities of that invention as an event worthy of a lot of media and public attention, but also the sense of the person as the kind of, you know, center of this, the inventor at the center of a perfect storm of thought and business and possibility and science that was going to very quickly be relevant to consumers, to families all over the country. That in the 1870s, 1880s, 1890s, all the way into the early 20th century with Edison was new, was important, and it echoes and rhymes every time Apple announces a new iPhone or a new iPad.
And this American Experience film really talks about how high the stakes were in so many of the decisions about how to proceed in terms of electrification. And I'm reminded that, you know, Edison was all about direct current, the kinds of electricity that comes out of your little batteries. But Westinghouse was competing with alternating current, and that's the current that comes out of the walls today. And this piece of tape is all about how Edison was so fiercely competitive that he wanted to brand Westinghouse as, well, you can just listen.
All of a sudden, Edison, who had always been against capital punishment, suddenly is completely behind the electric chair. And he feels that the best way to do this is to use, guess what, Westinghouse alternating current generators. And it is fully his intention to associate everything to do with Westinghouse and his electricity with death.
Michelle Ferrari, what is going on in that sort of notion that Edison and Westinghouse and the electric chair were trying to be linked there?
Well, Edison was, as you said, you know, sort of fiercely protecting his technology, and he went after his competitors in the lowest possible way. And at that point in his life, he'd been really focused on electricity for 10 years. I think he was a little bit restless, and he wasn't willing to put in the time to figure out the technical problems of delivering AC power. He wasn't willing to compete in an above board way, and so he went for the jugular. And he basically tried to instill in people a fear about the power of high voltage current.
Does the Edison brand survive today, Nancy, in a way that Edison would have liked, or not so much?
I think it does. I mean, I think he'd be surprised by how much resonance his name and achievements have, you know, somewhat 160 plus years after his birth. I don't think he'd be surprised by how many of the, you know, of the rhythms and activities and gadgets and just absolutely essential systems that every person uses today can trace many, many skeins back to him. I think even he, with his grand ego and his driving ambition, would be surprised by how much we today owe to Thomas Edison.
Nancy Cain is a historian at the Harvard Business School, a contributor to the film Edison, which is written and directed and co-produced by Michelle Ferrari of The American Experience. Michelle and Nancy, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
A real pleasure, John.
The new American Experience documentary, Edison, airs on PBS stations tonight at 9 p.m. Eastern Time, produced by our partner WGBH in Boston. Continuing our conversation all this week, Behind the Badge, Balancing the Force of Law and Order, a look at the American police force from the perspectives of the men and women who serve and some of the strategies that motivate how they serve. You've been sharing your stories of law enforcement in your community.
Hi, my name is Andrew Goodman, calling from San Francisco. I was a cop when the broken windows policy was first developed. My recollection is that the focus was on the appearance of the neighborhood. If a window was broken, you fixed the window. It didn't really have so much to do with heavy enforcement, and it seems to have turned into heavy police enforcement and not fixing the window.
The cop from San Francisco. Join the conversation. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or listen back to anything on the program at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.